Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Paul Roberts. He's an award-winning environmental journalist and the author of two books, The End of Oil and The End of Food. Writing in the New York Review of Books, Bill McKibben called The End of Oil a stunning piece of work, perhaps the single best book ever produced about our energy economy and its environmental implications. Paul, welcome to the program.
That's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, let's start with oil, and then we'll work our way up to food. In your book and in some of your other writings, you talk about something you call peak oil. Could you briefly explain to me what that concept is and why it's important?
Well, the idea there is that oil is a resource. It's finite. So, you know, at some point you're going to burn your way through all of it. And really what you're interested in is not when it ends, but when you hit the midpoint, because at that point it gets harder and harder to pull more of it out of the ground. We call that the peak because, generally speaking, after you've hit that midpoint, your production, your output, you know, the number of barrels you get a day begins to fall. And if you're in an economy that's growing and whose growth is dependent on energy use, that could be a pretty tough point.
And where are we regarding that point right now?
Well, now, if we knew that, I mean, that's the $6 trillion question, because you really have to know how much oil you have, you know, you had in the first place. What was your original endowment, as they call it? Mm-hmm. And there's a huge debate. So the pessimists would say that we passed the midpoint, you know, a couple years ago, and that explains why we're struggling to raise output today. And the optimists say, you know, we haven't even begun to tap the potential resources down there.
Is there a majority opinion on this? You have pessimists and optimists.
It's really tough. A couple years ago, when my book came out, actually, and prices were going up so fast, the pessimists were really in the ascendance. Mm-hmm. And more recently, since we've had a couple of big discoveries, since prices have dropped, now they're coming back up again, it's looking like, you know, there is more resource. You know, we're still not sure about how much more. This sort of dilemma has been around since the beginning of the oil business. And pessimists have been calling for the end of oil about every 10 years. And they're proven wrong. You know, a new technology will open up a new field. So if you're just letting the peak oil question drive your energy debate, you know, your energy policy, for example, should we come up with an alternative? You never will, because you'll always be able to argue there's more oil. So really that debate has to be driven by other factors.
I want to come back to something you mentioned about prices here in a minute, but I also wanted to ask you this question. In your book, you write that your overall goal is to provide, quote, a way for non-experts to begin to think about what experts have long known, that energy is the single most important resource, that our current energy system is failing, and that the shape of the next energy economy is being decided right now, with or without our input. Now, that was in 2004. So 8 years later, what was decided about the shape of our next energy economy?
That's really well put. I mean, you know, we're constantly having that debate without really explicitly saying this is what we're talking about. Because as a culture, we have a really hard time talking explicitly about energy policy. We'd rather sort of let the market take care of it. And by that, I mean we'd rather allow high prices to encourage oil companies and other companies to go out and find new oil and bring that oil onto the market. And ideally, you know, that helps relax prices. And then the debate goes away. I mean, we never as a people talk about oil or energy policy when prices are low. It's only when it's expensive. And that's really been so in terms of deciding the shape of the next energy economy, it's still pretty haphazard. Mm. You know, we're still that we'll make these tentative forays into alternative energy. You know, we'll try some solar, we'll try some ethanol. We don't have too much luck in those, so we sort of stop talking about it. And meanwhile, voters get very angry because it costs almost $5 a gallon for gasoline, and that's really the level that the debate stays at. You know, pissed off voters or drivers/voters.
I wanted to ask you a question about the public awareness about oil dependency in relation to gas prices, as you were just speaking. And going back to 2004, again, around the time of your book, you just mentioned this, many observers were saying that the high price of gas, which was then exceeding $2 a gallon, would be the turning point for us to really wrap our minds around these questions and to really address the kinds of things that you're talking about that we never really address. And I guess those were the good old days, but you just mentioned the gas is going up. Predictions that I'm reading are this summer $5 a gallon. Is this going to be the turning point?
You know, 30 years ago, we had the same debate. We had the first energy crisis. Prices went up to an inflation-adjusted rate that was about as high as we've got today. People stopped driving big cars. You know, we had this big revolution, or we thought a big revolution in terms of alternatives, smaller cars. As soon as prices drop, people go back to their old habits. And we've seen that time and time again. We're seeing it now. I mean, you could argue that the part of the 2008 financial crisis and the recession, it was in part the result of Detroit just getting hammered because it had bet on big cars. People stopped driving them when gas got expensive, and that really pulled the rug out from under a very important industry. So we saw car size diminish, and we were making the same argument. Wow, we figured it out. And people are right back into buying larger cars again. I think the fundamental truth here is that we've learned that we can survive gasoline at $4.50, $5 a gallon. I mean, we don't like it. And if your economy is already stressed out by total over-leverage, then maybe high prices will be the thing that finally breaks the straw that breaks the camel's back. But if the economy is relatively healthy, most of us can handle that gasoline at that price, which means that if you're wanting to transform the energy system, you'll need something other than price.
And what might that be? Are we talking about another major international conflict or?
Well, I mean, clearly if oil prices were to double, and you were to see gasoline at $8 a gallon, that would be another order of magnitude in terms of an effect. But, barring that, you're going to need sort of a conscious decision about the kind of technology we want to have, or maybe a goal in terms of how much, what's our miles per gallon goal? Mm-hmm. Do we think 80 miles per gallon is reasonable, 100 miles per gallon? Because right now we're sitting sort of in the high 20s, low 30s, and we're saying that ought to do. And that's not revolutionary at all. That's basically status quo. So you need to make a decision about your goals. You also need to make a decision about transportation generally. Right now we're focusing on the car. What we really need to do is focus on how people get around. If we look at cities, cities are where most of us are going to live. And it turns out that a person's footprint, their impact in terms of sustainability, is really driven by the shape of the city they live in. So, and that makes sense, the transportation alternatives that are offered, et cetera. So that needs to be where our focus of our debate is, not just whether we drive a Volt or a Prius, it's whether we drive at all and whether we need to drive and whether there's a cultural imperative to drive. Those are much tougher issues to settle because they're not just driven by some technological innovation. It's a change of mindset. And culturally, we really haven't proven too open to those kinds of changes.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Paul Roberts, the environmental journalist and the author of The End of Oil. Well, you've also written about natural gas being a possible bridge fuel for us to transition to a cleaner energy economy. And I think, as you know, getting the gas out of the ground has become quite controversial, and it's particularly controversial in this area of New York State. So what are your current thoughts about that?
Well, this is a classic example of our sort of push into an alternative energy scenario without fully considering all the consequences. So sort of in a theoretical sense, gas is a great thing to move to because if you're thinking about – I mean, we're talking about electricity generation. Most of our electrical generation in this country comes from things like coal and nuclear, mm-hmm. and those are both very controversial. If you switch from coal to natural gas, you reduce your emissions – depending on the emission, substantially, whether it's carbon dioxide, sulfur, NOx, all these emissions go down. And so the idea has been, since we have a lot of natural gas, it would make sense to sort of move gradually from coal to natural gas for our power generation. And keep in mind that power generation is going to be critical in the future for, things like transportation, computing, all these things. We make this shift and it's cleaner and we reduce our emissions. And then at some point in the future, we find something beyond gas that's even cleaner than gas because gas still has impurities. It still has carbon dioxide. But it's a great sort of bridge fuel. That's the idea. The problem is the reason we say that gas is so abundant today is because we found all these new technologies to get it out of the ground. And one of those, of course, is hydraulic fracking, which, as you and your listeners know, is pretty controversial. So I guess the takeaway here is that there are options here, but none of them are easy. You know, there's no free lunch here. Every change we make imposes a cost. And we're all about the benefits of the change, but we rarely want to, you know, confront the costs.
And you mentioned nuclear power there just a second ago. Some people have criticized your writing for underplaying the role that nuclear power might play in this. And I just wanted to ask you, how do you see nuclear power factoring into either the transition to a different energy economy down the road or in that new economy itself?
Well, I think that, you know, the generation of nuclear technology that we've got right now has a couple of serious downsides. You know, you've got the storage of spent fuel issue. You have the security issue. You have the political issue about where do you store it. I mean, this country is we're really paralyzed by where to put this stuff. There are on the drawing board a number of sort of next generation nuclear technologies that are smaller, more distributed. You don't have to have these massive, central, super expensive plants that offer a potential. I think the safest sort of forecast to make is that nuclear is part of the mix. But anytime you try to rely on one particular, you know, energy as opposed to a broad portfolio, you're setting yourself up for a pretty big risk. Because if any of those things fail, for example, if it turns out that fracking, we can't make it environmentally safe. I mean, let's just say that takes a big piece out of our energy portfolio. So we better have alternatives. It's the same thing with nuclear. You know, at the end of the day, really, it's going to take a mix of a bunch of different kinds of technologies and fuels. And again, we can't really risk relying on one, you know, putting all our eggs in one basket.
And that particular source of energy seems to me to be particularly sensitive to politics and changing public opinion. And when there's a major accident, then that is something that the public really does respond to and react to. Do you think that makes nuclear power different in terms of its place in the mix of the bridge fuels and the new economy?
Well, okay, so nuclear has the Godzilla effect going on. You know, it's clearly it has the potential for a you know sort of massive failure, which can have a you know long-standing effect. So that weighs on policymakers certainly, but there are sort of more mundane things about nuclear. I mean, right now when we build a plant, we're talking billions and billions of dollars. So very few players can afford to finance or are willing to afford to finance something like that. You have to insure these things, which is massively expensive. The regulatory obstacles are pretty big. And so if you're a power company, you're looking at it, you're thinking, well, okay, in a perfect world, I would invest my $2 billion and then the operating costs are pretty minimal. But this isn't a perfect world. So I'd much rather invest in natural gas, you know, gas-fired or even coal, maybe clean coal. Or maybe I'll invest in solar. So there's a real market factor here, too, which has as much to do with nuclear in the mix as politics does.
Well, I wonder if you could evaluate the Obama administration in terms of facilitating our shift toward a more sustainable environmental and energy economy. We're well into the first administration here toward the end of it. How do you think they've done?
Well, you know, the Obama administration was never really sort of radical on energy and or particularly progressive, and you know they talked some of the talk, but really they've been centrist. They've continued the sort of Clinton sort of in terms of Democrats. They've continued the Clinton policy of expanding production. You know he's made a few efforts to push alternatives. They haven't been all that successful. The whole solar you know subsidies, federal subsidies for solar, the solar industry hasn't worked out all that well. For pretty complex reasons. I mean, it wasn't simply corruption, but and I think you know the larger sort of characteristic of the Obama energy policy has been expanding oil and gas production. I mean, for all that Republicans and a lot of drivers feel that you know high gas prices are because Obama's prohibiting drilling, it's actually the opposite. You know, he's expanded drilling and he's behind natural gas production too. So I think it's more been status quo. But I think that to be fair, you have to recognize that if we're let's imagine that we had a new technology that was going to allow us to drive cars without oil or any hydrocarbon. It ran on air, okay, and it was it was totally affordable, and it was cool. We liked it, you know, and it was ready to go tomorrow. And in fact, it's all you could buy. Okay, so it's the only technology available anywhere in the world. It would still take us about 15 years to shift the fleet. Because that's how long it takes people to buy new cars. It's how long it takes car makers to make new cars. Unless you want to massively accelerate the process, but that's expensive. So we're looking at 15 years, and that's an absurdly best case scenario. We don't have the technology. We might have something like that in 20 years. So we're looking at 35, 40 years, 50 years. Is you start thinking to make this transition to this. Okay, during that time, what happens to the rest of our transportation infrastructure? We have to run it. And it uses oil. So you need a massive amount of oil during that time, that 50-year period. Now, ideally, near the end of that transition, you're using less oil every year. But still, gobs and gobs. What it means is you have to maintain your oil system during that transition. Even if Al Gore was elected president of the world tomorrow, we're talking about you need a lot of oil to get away from oil. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a lot of environmentalists sometimes downplay. Is the need for conventional energy. Now, the danger of that argument is that you can always say, well, there's no reason to change, right? You have to start the transition today with the idea that you're going to wean yourself from oil in half a century so that you don't get to 50 years from now and say, wow, we didn't make any progress. The Obama administration, like the Bush administration, could argue we're just taking care of the existing infrastructure while you guys build the green infrastructure. But the problem is we're not yet building the green infrastructure.
Mm. Well, I want to also talk to you briefly about your book on food. And in the end of food, you demonstrate the inefficiencies involved in producing and eating meat. And I think the basic arguments about that are familiar to many of our listeners, but you also write about how heavily nitrogen figures into food intake, and you estimate that almost half of the calories that we produce come from synthetically produced nitrogen. I wonder if you could talk about that fact and its importance.
Sure. Now, and I want to give credit to where it's due. That's from an economist named Vaclav Smil, who University of Manitoba, and he is the go-to guy for sort of these deep facts on the nuts and bolts of the food economy. But Smil has found that, if you look at how many people we have alive today, a large fraction of those people exist because we came up with a way to synthesize nitrogen and use it as a fertilizer. Had we not been able to do that in the middle of the last century, a population wouldn't be this big. And right there you realize the paradox. Had we not become so efficient at producing so much food, there wouldn't be so many of us to feed. So, all right, well, for better or for worse, we're here. Now we recognize that we've got this capacity to sort of industrially produce massive amounts of food, including meat. But it turns out that there are a lot of costs, and nitrogen is one of those. Because we can so readily synthesize it, we use it rather freely. Farmers in many countries, including the United States, typically use nitrogen as a sort of an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. That is, when prices are high, say the price of corn is high, you realize that it's much easier to just go ahead and over-apply, that is, apply more than you would of nitrogen fertilizer to ensure that you get maximum bushels per acre because you'll get your money back. The risk there, obviously, is that nitrogen doesn't all get absorbed by the food, and in fact, it runs off the soil into whatever water systems you have around it. So we have this, and in this country, of course, a lot of that ends up in the Mississippi, which ends in the Mississippi Delta, and you have these massive dead spots where all this overabundance of nitrogen just kills off all sorts of life. That is one of the external costs of this industrial food system. And yet, for an individual farmer, it's really tough to not use nitrogen as an insurance policy because, the risk of under-fertilizing is worse from a financial standpoint.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Paul Roberts. Well, you've written now two books about the end of something important. If you were going to write a book about the beginning of something important, what would it be?
First, you should know that most of my family thinks that I need to come up with more optimistic titles, that I could probably sell some books if I, came up with a happy title. So I think I would like to – I've been pretty good. I think a lot of journalists are good at sort of analyzing the problem, what's wrong with the system. And I think that the challenge is to come up with ways to fix a broken system and not just big policy methods. We talk about a carbon tax, which is great. It's important. We have to make energy reflect its real costs. But for the individual listening to a talk about energy policy and carbon tax, it's like blah, blah, blah. First of all, it's complicated. Second, what does it mean to them as an individual? You need something that you can do at home, your community, with your neighbors. And I think that's the step, is coming up with meaningful action on the individual and community level. And so that's my sort of my focus these days.
Are you writing a book on that topic?
Well, I'm working on a book on sort of related on the sort of the links between the digital economy and individual identity.
Hmm.
So, you know, we have an economy that delivers more and more of what you want when you want it. It's very personalized, you know your iPhone, your whatever. And my question is, what does that do to the formation of the self? I mean, we weren't designed to be catered to. We were designed to adapt to our environment. And in that process of adaptation, we toughen up, we mature, and we get some distance from our material sort of imperatives, and that's where wisdom comes in. Maybe that's how you get spiritual growth. I mean, that's how it's been in the past. You could argue that in the last century, we've sort of reversed that process because it's no longer essential to adapt to anything. We make the world adapt to us. And in fact, we get pretty pissed off when the world doesn't adapt to us. I mean, think about it. You're in an airport, and your flight's been delayed because of a tornado. I mean, the nerve of the weather to delay you. And yet, that's the attitude that that's emerged because we have the technological capacity to reshape the world to such an extent.
I did want to ask you, has the research that you've done for the end of oil and the end of food and your writing about it, has it affected the way you live your own life in any significant way?
Yeah, it has, actually. You know, you can't do a lot of work on, say, the production of meat, industrial production of meat, and without wondering, wow, should I be eating so much of this? So that's certainly changed the way how much meat I eat and the kind of meat. I'm constantly amazed when I come home from the store and I'm unpacking the groceries and I'm just thinking, how would I duplicate any of these products, any of these services, if the system were to break down? So it's made me realize how vulnerable we all are, and it's made me explore some sort of more local alternatives.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I guess letting go of the past and moving forward.
And second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is my inability to let go of the past. I mean, yeah, I'm in the golden oldies section right now.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think my interest in teaching. You know, first how hard it is. You know, the respect I have for teachers and professors who do this regularly, but second, the pleasure that you get from making a connection with people who are coming up and sort of making their own decisions about what they want to do. So that was sort of a surprise to see that.
That was Paul Roberts. His books are The End of Oil and The End of Food. Paul, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.